Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 86566, Barclay Perry and James Johnston versus Kenneth Thomas. Mr. Dolan, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. The issues on this appeal from a decision of the California Court of Appeal for the Second Appellate District are whether that court, in affirming the order of the Los Angeles County Superior Court denying the petition of appellants to compel arbitration of the claims asserted against them, first, incorrectly based its decision squarely on where, which it says in so many words in the opinion itself, whether it disregarded the ruling of this court in Southland versus Keating, whether it failed to follow the ruling of this court in Dean Wither Reynolds versus Byrd by refusing to sever the non-wage claims, which it felt were non-arbitrable under Labor Code Section 229, and referring the balance of the claims to arbitration, and whether it erred in applying Labor Code Section 229 in the first instance, contrary to the Federal Arbitration Act and in violation of the Supremacy Clause. I think it would be useful to recap very quickly the chronology of the case, because we come to you not after a trial, and the record is very limited. Now, Mr. Thomas, the appellee in this case, was employed by Kidder Peabody in August of 1982 as an account executive. In the prior years, he had also been employed by other New York Stock Exchange member firms, including Morgan Stanley, E.F. Hutton, and Kenneth Fitzgerald. I make that observation because I think it's only fair to assume that Mr. Thomas either had or should have had a working knowledge of the rules, which he says he read in signing the U-4. He'd been in the industry for many, many years. Rule 347, which provides the arbitration, is a longstanding rule. This Court addressed it in Ware in 1973 and had been on the books for many years before that. In August of 1982, Mr. Thomas signed the U-4, which contains the express arbitration agreement upon which our petition was based. In May of 1984, a dispute arose between Thomas and his colleague, Mr. Johnston, Kidder Peabody, his employer, and Barclay Perry, the manager of the Los Angeles office of Kidder Peabody.
There was an express provision for arbitration?
Yes, Your
In
Honor.
His employment contract?
That is found.
It wasn't just a reference to New York Stock Exchange rules or anything like that?
No, Your Honor. It reads...
Well, that's all I really
that's
need.
That's page 33A. Now, the form of the U-4 has varied over the years. Mm-hmm. There was a time when there was only an incorporation by reference.
But this is expressed.
This particular one says, I agree to arbitrate any dispute, claim, or controversy that may arise between me and my firm or a customer or any other person that is required to be arbitrated under the rules, constitutions, or bylaws of the organizations with which I register, as indicated in question 8, one of those organizations, New York Stock Exchange.
Well, that's by reference, then.
Well, the reference is only as to the ambit of the arbitration agreement. That is to say, whether he agrees to arbitrate wage disputes or working conditions or the dress that he has to wear to the office or things of that sort. But there is an express agreement to arbitrate controversies with his employer and with any other person, which would include Perry and Johnston. Mm-hmm. And that language does not appear in other versions, earlier versions of the U-4. And I might say there's no issue but that he signed it. Apart from the fact that his signature was notarized, his declaration, which is in the record, says that does not say he didn't sign it, doesn't even say he didn't read it. Simply says that no one apprised him of the significance of it.
Your clients here claim to be third-party beneficiaries of that agreement, is that?
That's correct. And their standing in that situation has been established 12 years ago in Byrne versus Dean Wither Reynolds in the state courts of California, and by the Ninth Circuit in 1986 in the Letizia decision. It would have no meaning if they enter into an arbitration agreement with a corporation that can act only by its employees, officers, and directors. and then assert a claim against them individually and avoid the arbitration. That issue has been raised and decided, in our own state, more than 12 years ago, and the Berman decision is 1975. The Ninth Circuit decided it in 1986, also involving a registered representative.
The court just assumed it in this case. It didn't really decide it, did it?
In this
particular litigation, they didn't. They just assumed there was standing. They didn't really. Didn't they say in a footnote they assume it without reaching the question?
That's correct. And the Court of Appeal did.
Yeah.
Because Mr. Thomas contested that. He did not do so in the trial court. And therefore, that issue was waived by the time he got to the Court of Appeal.
Were these your clients employed by the same employer at the time that he signed this contract?
Exactly. In fact, Barclay Perry also signed the U4 in his capacity as manager of the Los Angeles office of Kidder Peabody. Johnston was also employed as an account executive. They were colleagues. The relationship between Johnston and Thomas was one of a commission-sharing sort. And the dispute has to do with which of them was entitled to commissions that were derived from the sale of securities owned by a particular customer who, in the complaint, Mr. Thomas alleges he introduced to the firm. And therein lies the dispute. Of course, those commissions are payable by the firm, and we'll get to that a little bit later as to who the employer is and whether or not either Perry or Johnston ought to be involved in the labor code dispute in the first place.
The standing issue really is turned on state law, doesn't it? How far, what the extent of the contract between the two of you is and how far the Cal labor code extends?
I don't think the first question was ever raised or is a problem in this case. The extension of the California labor code, of course, is the centerpiece of this appeal. And I must say that 229 of the labor code, if read reasonably, will not conflict with the Federal Arbitration Act. And it will not raise the concerns that I know members of this Court have previously articulated when you extend the Federal Arbitration Act such as to overrule state regulatory policies.
But, you know, the California Court of Appeal here unreasonably, I guess, in your view, read it so it did conflict.
Well, the California Court of Appeal squarely based its decision on Ware and says so. And one of the most curious things about the opinion of the Court of Appeal, which is only four pages, found in the appendix at, I believe, page 136, it makes no mention whatsoever of Southland. Now, we started relying on Southland in the very first set of papers we filed in the Superior Court. The original petition to compel arbitration and the motion for an order staying proceedings were based on the Federal Arbitration Act, and the memorandum of points of authority supporting that motion and petition expressly set forth, quoted, and cited both Southland and Moses Cone. So it isn't as if the state courts of California were not aware of it. Indeed, I cannot explain to you why it is that the Court of Appeals decision simply ignored both Moses Cone and Southland, as well as its companion decision of a sister court, of a Fourth District Court of Appeal in Tinetti versus Shirley. The complaint was filed in January 1985, and the complaint is worthy of examination because it, Mr. Chief Justice, will respond somewhat to your question as to the reach of 229 of the California Labor Code. The complaint cites is a form complaint, which you are now using in California on an optional basis, where you check the boxes and then put in some additional narrative statements. It is without question that it asserts only common law claims for conversion, for conspiracy to commit conversion, for the breach of a fiduciary duty, for breach of contract, and for a claim for exemplary and punitive damages. Now, Judge O'Brien referred to these other claims as ancillary to the wage claim. The Court of Appeal describes them in terms of other theories, but there's a little bit more to it than that. The breach of contract, we're talking about $40,000 in commissions claims, sought damages only in the amount of $40,000. The conversion, conspiracy, and breach of fiduciary duty claims, however, seek $150,000. And as is not surprising, the exemplary and punitive damage claim seeks $1.5 million. Something that I believe is well beyond the reasonable ambit of either ancillary claims or simply different theories.
How does this line of argument bear on the question presented here, whether 229 is preempted by the Arbitration Act?
Because 229, by its very words, is limited to actions provided in Article 1.
But the California Court of Appeals held otherwise, didn't it?
No. The California Court of Appeals simply said that this court held otherwise in the 1973 decision in Ware. and based its decision squarely on where?
Well, are you saying that the interpretation that the California Court of Appeals made of Section 229 in this case, wherever it got it from, is wrong?
Yes.
Well, that's a question we just don't deal with here.
But you did. You did deal with it in 1973 when you made the Ware decision, and that's the problem.
Well, I would assume that the Ware decision took California law as it came from the California courts.
Well, I regret to say, Your Honor, that 229 had not previously been construed before the Ware decision came down from this court in 1973.
But your case doesn't depend on that, does it?
On Ware?
No, on the construction of the California statute.
Absolutely. I mean the Mr. Thomas' case depends entirely on that, because without that statute, then he has no shield or arbitration.
Well, that may be so, but how about your case?
No, my position, I could simply say that no matter how you construe it.
You're bound to get around to saying that.
I think I have said it. That no matter how you construe it, it's still in violation of the Federal Arbitration Act. But I don't really think you need to go that far.
We don't really much care, Mr. Dolan, how California chooses to interpret Section 229. I mean, that's what you're up against. We really don't care how California chooses to interpret 229.
I appreciate that.
You can't win, except on this argument that law is preempted.
Well,
if a case comes to us, the reach of that law is a given.
I have a bit of a dilemma, which I'll explain to you on that point. We have a California rule of court, 977, which prohibits us from citing or relying upon unpublished opinions in other cases. Our courts of appeal have made a regular practice of issuing unpublished opinions. The issue that is being raised right now was addressed in an opinion by the California Court of Appeal in January of this year, in a case involving Shearson Lehman and American Express. Unfortunately, it's an unpublished opinion. It, in fact, does distinguish and construe 229 in the fashion that we would suggest. And we only raise the construction question in anticipating the concern of the court for aligning the Federal Arbitration Act with legitimate state policies. And the reason I make reference to the complaint
If you lose, the Ware's construction of this section is correct, why?
No.
You don't want to say that, do you?
I do not want to say it. I don't believe I have said it, and I don't believe that anything in the record suggests it will. All I'm saying is, Your Honor, is that the California Court of Appeal, in its decision, made no attempt itself, as a California court, to construe 229,
I spend a lot of my time in deciding this case on what the construction of 229 is.
I understand. And I don't mean to get off on a tangent.
Well, you have been.
Well, the reason I raised it is with respect to the complaint. If the complaint does not allege claims under Article 1 of the Labor Code, then 229 simply doesn't apply. No matter how you construe it, it simply doesn't apply by its own terms. The complaint also alleges that at all times here in material, the defendant, referring to Perry and Johnson, were acting in the course and scope of their employment for defendant Kidder Peabody. The answer was filed by the appellants on the 13th of February. A written demand was sent the same day for arbitration. The answer was a short-form general denial answer, which asserted as a affirmative defense the entitlement to arbitration. On the 19th of February, and this becomes important in the scheme of things as to why we split between Kidder Peabody and the two individuals and going to state and federal court, the Court of Appeal issues its initial decision in the other case that I referred to, Tinetti versus Shirley. In that case, they ruled against Kidder Peabody and Shirley, who was the manager of its Newport Beach office, and did not allow arbitration of their claims. We petitioned for rehearing. The rehearing order was granted. And ultimately, the Tinetti case went the other way. The motion for order staying proceedings and the arbitration petition were both filed on the 22nd of February. A separate petition was filed in the United States District Court on behalf of Kidder Peabody. The order granting the rehearing in Tinetti came down on the 21st of March, a little less than a month later. The hearing was conducted by Judge O'Brien in the Superior Court on the 5th of April of 85. He issued his minute order on the 10th of April of 85. We requested a statement of decision. We got one. On the 25th of April, 1985, Judge Kelleher and the district court, based on Judge O'Brien's decision, dismissed Peter Peabody's petition. We then filed our notice of appeal of Judge O'Brien's decision. We went to the Court of Appeal. In October of 1985, the second Tanetti opinion came down. That opinion is very important because it upholds the supremacy of the Federal Arbitration Act in California in these arbitration questions. It did not do so in the earlier version that came down in February of 1985. The opinion of the Court of Appeal, which we are appealing here, was issued on the 10th of April, and as I indicated, is very short, makes no mention whatsoever of Southland or Moses Cone. Doesn't attempt to distinguish it or explain it, simply makes no mention of it. It says, in so many words, that its decision is based squarely on Ware. It rejected the severance of claims after noting our citation to Dean Witterell's versus Byrd and made no mention whatsoever of Tanetti. As I previously indicated, Perry and Johnson have beneficiaries of the agreement by virtue of the well-established case law, and that, frankly, was not challenged in the trial court and is not on appeal here. It is our position that Southland, the decision of this court in January 1984, is the controlling authority in this case, not Ware. And that position is simply based on the fact that our petition does not contend and has never contended that 229 of the California Labor Code is preempted by Rule 347 of the New York Stock Exchange. That was the position in Ware. Rather, our position is that there is little difference between California Labor Code Section 229 and California Corporations Code Section 31.512, which this court held was preempted by the Federal Arbitration Act in the Southland decision. Ware did not decide the preemption question from the standpoint of the Federal Arbitration Act. Indeed, the California Supreme Court, in its decision in Keating, made that determination. It may well be a gratuitous observation so far as this court is concerned, but it certainly was not insofar as the California Court of Appeal was concerned. There was no attempt by the California Court of Appeal to distinguish Southland because it didn't even mention it. And it was briefed to a fairly well and just left alone.
Mr. Dolan, before you – can I go back to standing for just a second? I believe you answered me earlier by quoting this provision of the agreement, the third-party beneficiary agreement. As a matter of California law, they are third-party beneficiaries of contract and therefore have standing. Is that your argument?
No, the position is the Berman case says that non-signatories.
Which is a Berman case?
Berman versus Dean Witter Reynolds is the 1975 California Court of Appeal case.
As a matter of California law, non-signatories may enforce an agreement of this kind as third-party beneficiaries.
That's correct, and it was an agreement of this very kind. It was the same kind of agreement.
But is it not true that as a matter of California law, insofar as this agreement provides for the recovery of wages, it's unenforceable? No, it's not unenforceable, just unenforceable in arbitration. That's what it is.
I would differ with
that. In fact,
that.
It is unenforceable. You know, the agreement to arbitrate is unenforceable as a matter of California law.
Well, that's where I think that assumption is made, but that is not what the statute says.
Isn't that what 229 says?
No. See, the California Court of Appeal, in its opinion, which is found at 139 at SEC of the Joint Appendix, it quotes in a curious fashion in footnote 2 at the bottom of page 140, Labor Code 229. It says, Labor Code Section 229 states in pertinent part, quote, actions, ellipses, for the collection of due and unpaid wages claimed by an individual may be maintained without regard to the existence of any private agreement. But let me tell you what the ellipses provides.
Whatever it provides, apparently the author of the opinion didn't think the ellipses were very important.
Well, I think this Court should. Again, we're getting drawn into the construction question, but whether or not it applies and whether you should concern yourself with it, it says the action to enforce the provisions of this article. Provisions of this article. In other words, this is not a general statute that says any arbitration agreement in respect of wages is unenforceable in California. The article is very precise in the kinds of actions that are authorized.
Let me ask you, put my question this way. If we read the Court of Appeals opinion as assuming that 229 made this agreement arbitrate, unenforceable as a matter of California law, then would it not be correct that your basis for standing as third-party beneficiaries relies on a contractual provision that, as a matter of state law, is unenforceable?
No, the arbitration agreement itself is not otherwise unenforceable. It's simply as it relates to the wage claim on the
bill. Well, insofar as it has relevance to this litigation, which I take it from the California opinion is assumed to be a wage claim within the meaning of the statute.
Well, therein lies the problem. See, the complaint does not allege a labor code wage claim, but it alleges a lot of these common law torts which would not otherwise be exempted from the arbitration agreement, even if the 229 analysis you just made were to apply. That's our problem.
Common law torts and the like aren't covered by the Arbitration Act.
But California case law has unequivocally held that torts are subject to arbitration. The problem is very similar to that in Byrd. In Byrd, you were concerned with the arbitrability of a 34 Act claim and how that intertwined with the state law pendant claims in the district court in the Byrd case. At that point,
there was a standing in that case, was there?
No.
All of my inquiry is not directed to the merits, but merely as to whether there's standing as a matter of federal constitutional law, which, as I understand it, you rely for the predicate for your whole standing argument is a California rule of law which makes this contract unenforceable, insofar as it relates to this controversy.
Well, the case of controversy existed well before we ever got to the California decision. As soon as they were made involuntary defendants in the complaint, they were involved in a case of controversy. They then sought to enforce the arbitration provision to have that resolved elsewhere. So I think we passed muster under Article 3 without any question at all. An analysis of the labor code sections that I mentioned would indicate that there are a number of other provisions that are enforceable only by the state and some only in the name of the state. And some of the penalties that are recoverable can only be recovered and paid to the state, and actions can only be brought in the name of the Labor Commission. So 229, in my view, applies to those actions and not to private litigants. It also talks about the Labor Commissioner's hearings that are held under Labor Code Section 206, another action which we do not contend would be frustrated by the court reversing the Court of Appeal. We don't contend that forcing Mr. Thomas to arbitrate his common law claims against Perry and Johnson should in any way be regarded as undercutting the California Labor Commissioner's statutory authority to inquire into the wage disputes and to conduct hearings and to make awards as appropriate. In conclusion, I would like to reserve my time to respond to...
Do me one favor. That thing on page 33A of your appendix, which is very hard to read, I agree to arbitrate any dispute, claim, or controversy that may arise between me and my firm or a customer or any other person that is required to be arbitrated under the rules, blah, blah, blah.
That's right.
You really have to refer to the rules to see what any claim by any other person means. And how does any other person mean a co-employee under the arbitration rules to which this provision refers?
The decision of the California Court of Appeal in Berman versus Dean Witter Reynolds and the decision of the Ninth Circuit in Letizia versus Prudential Beige, those are the authorities that we rely on to extend this particular agreement to include the non-signatories, Perry and Johnston. For the sake of your eyesight, Justice Scalia, that language is reproduced on page 21A, which we put it into our original papers.
21.
Unfortunately, when they took a picture of this to reduce it for the size of the brief, it got a lot smaller. But you'll find in the middle of that.
That question that you just answered for Justice Scalia is a question of California contract law, I take it. Well, whether this particular agreement embraces a particular situation.
Or specifically whether or not Johnson and Perry are the beneficiaries of the arbitration agreement. Yes. Okay. I wonder if I can reserve the balance of my time to rebut.
Yes, you may. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Galbraith.
Mr. Chief Justice, and if it please the Court, There are certain rights which are sacred and fundamental in the law, and as this Court recognized in 1973 in its unanimous decision in Ware, foremost amongst those is a wage earner's rights to the fruits of his labor, not to just part of the fruits of his labor, but to all of the fruits of his labor. Now, in enacting Labor Code Section 229, the California legislature, in its wisdom, felt that arbitration was less than an adequate remedy for redressing disputes over wages. And when this matter came before this Court in 1973, all eight justices who participated saw clearly that California had a historical constitutional prerogative to protect its wage earners in this matter. Now, our case is based first on Ware. We've discussed Ware, whether or not it's on all fours and completely applicable. I like to think of Ware as being 80% on point. We are dealing with a wage earner who has brought a civil action to recover his wages. The employer and co-employees who have defended on the case have raised that Form U-4, claiming that he has agreed to arbitrate any dispute that may arise.
Are we dealing with the Federal Arbitration Act in Ware? Unfortunately, that's
that,
20%.
That I think you foresaw that is the 20% that may be in dispute. But let me answer it this way. First, as the Court here found in Byrd, the Federal Arbitration Act is a matter of substantive law. So that whether Merrill Lynch, back in the days of Ware, relied on the Federal Arbitration Act or the State Arbitration Act in bringing its motion to compel arbitration should make no cognizable difference.
Oh, that's not so. I mean, perfectly valid issues of substantive law are given away all the time by failure of litigants to raise them.
Well, it would.
The fact is, this wasn't raised or addressed in Ware, was it?
Your Honor, I would like to point out that this Court was fully mindful of the Federal Arbitration Act as it cited it at footnote 15 of the Ware decision. And it is difficult to believe that the Ware case would have turned on whether or not the attorneys for Merrill Lynch were perceptive enough to raise the Federal Arbitration Act instead of just the State Arbitration Act.
Oh, well, the treatment of Ware, of the Federal Arbitration Act in Ware, may suggest that the Moses Cone decision, the Southland decision, were somewhat unforeseeable. But I think you have a hard time saying that reading the Ware opinion and saying that that court viewed the Federal Arbitration Act the same way the court viewed it in Southland.
Well, the Federal Arbitration Act, Mr. Chief Justice, has been in effect long before Ware. And any impact it would have would have been fully available to this Court.
But it was rediscovered in Southland.
Well, as things get rediscovered, the legislature intent does not change with the passage of time. In Southland, we had a very interesting dissent that you joined in which you felt that the Federal Arbitration Act didn't even apply to a state action such as this. And
that
perhaps
lost.
That should be reconsidered.
That lost. That so I wouldn't convict. Rest my argument on the dissent. If
but
I
Justice O'Connor was a very perceptive opinion. I felt that perhaps you can persuade your new brother on the bench.
What do you say to the view of the majority in Southland?
I say
you
to
really
the majority.
Have a problem.
I say to the majority that when we are dealing with a commercial dispute, perhaps that's appropriate for arbitration. But if we look at Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act, there is a savings clause which says that certain disputes are not going to be arbitrated where they fall within a matter of law or equity and are revocable on those grounds. Now, the question is, do the states have a right to establish those perimeters? Now, I'm aware of the fact that in Byrd and Southland, you have indicated, that is, the Court has indicated, that the states are denied the right to carve out exceptions to the Federal Arbitration Act. And therefore, it falls upon this Court as a matter of federal common law to carve out those exceptions to the Federal Arbitration Act that Congress intended when it enacted the Savings Clause in Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act. Now, while Ware may not be directly on point because of Merrill Lynch's use of the State Arbitration Act rather than the Federal Arbitration Act, nevertheless, the policy language which is throughout Ware points out the fact that there are certain circumstances in which an arbitration act used by an employer in advance of an employee's dispute can have an undesirable economic effect. And I feel that that is just as applicable today as it was when the court reviewed Ware back in 1973.
But it's one thing for the court to say that, as it did, I believe, in Ware, that California was entitled to reconcile its Section 229 and its State Arbitration Act in a particular way, and this court would accept it. But it's another thing to say that the same reconciliation would have to take place between the Federal Act and then the California statute.
Your Honor, that would presuppose that there is a difference in the policy between the Federal Arbitration Act and the Securities and Exchange Act. After all, when you decided the case in Ware, the first point that you raised is that we are dealing with the issue of preemption. Preemption was the Federal Act, Securities Act versus Labor's Code Section 229. And it is the same analysis that applies in this case. We are dealing with the preemption model. That is the Federal Act, the Federal Arbitration Act, inconsistent with Labor Code Section 229, or do the states have that constitutional prerogative to create certain exceptions for the benefit of its wage earners?
This particular argument, if the promise to arbitrate here made no reference whatsoever to the New York Stock Exchange rules, but the arbitration provision said, I agree to arbitrate, and then they listed all the agreements, all the kinds of disputes that were to be arbitrated, and that this case involved one of those listed. Would you be making this argument?
If it involved one other than for wages?
No, just whatever. It involved the very dispute that is here, which is for what? The dispute is over what here?
The dispute is over wages and different theories for recovering wages and different remedies.
All right, let's assume that that kind of a dispute is one of the disputes that was listed, expressly listed in the contract to be arbitrated.
Yes, Your Honor, I would make the same argument because it violates public policy.
All right, but you couldn't be making an argument based on congressional intent not to preempt in the securities laws. You would have to face up squarely to the Federal Arbitration Act.
Your Honor, we believe that there is a federal common law that would protect the wage earner in this case, and that Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act says that there are exceptions. It does not define what the exceptions are.
I think you're missing Justice White's point. I think the point is that it's sort of the tail wagging the dog if we're going to let our interpretation of a federal securities arbitration provision and as to its preemptive effect determine what the preemptive effect of the much broader Federal Arbitration Act is going to be. That's what you're asking us to do. You're asking us to say, since we determined that this little federal securities law didn't preempt any state law, which covers, you know, relatively, I know to you people here it seems like the whole world, but it's a small aspect of human endeavor. You're saying that the determination we made on that has to govern our interpretation of the Federal Arbitration Act, which covers everything.
Your Honor, I believe the policies are same or similar as they relate to the two. After all, the Federal Arbitration Act basically abrogates the common law hostility towards enforcing arbitration agreements. The securities exchange provisions do not differ greatly. The policy is fairly similar, and appellants have certainly not shown us how the policy under the Federal Arbitration Act, which was in full force in effect at the time of Ware, is any different than under the Securities and Exchange Act. Now, if I may address some issues that the Court raised during my opponent's presentation, we have, in regard to standing, two points I wish to make. First, The issue of standing was raised at the trial level before the California Superior Court, and I direct the Court's attention to pages 78A and 120A of the Joint Appendix.
Mr. Gelber, what do you mean by the issue of standing in this case?
What I mean by the issue of standing is that where we have a controversy over the right to compel arbitration, the party compelling arbitration has to have some vested interest or a vested right, such as a third-party beneficiary right, to raise.
That party has to have a contractual right to compel arbitration?
Correct.
And where do we look for a determination of that question?
I was going to get to that. I just wanted you to know that we did raise that at the trial level and the Court of Appeals erred on that point. Now, moving to your question, Mr. Chief Justice, I believe if we just construe the agreements that we have here, we look first to Form U-4.
But it's a matter of California law, isn't it? It's a contract executed in California.
Right, but I believe the interpretation would apply to this Court sitting in view of the agreements.
We don't have any independent law of contracts here, as since Erie Railroad against Tompkins. It's up to California to decide what a California contract means.
Unfortunately, the Court of Appeals didn't address the issue,
They certainly did by implication.
Because they felt that it was not timely raised, and they were in error on that point, as I've pointed out by reference to the record here. But if I might just point out that the arbitration clause that Mr. Thomas signed states that he agrees to arbitrate any dispute which is required to be arbitrated by the Exchange Act rules. However, Rule 347 of the Exchange does not require Mr. Thomas to arbitrate any dispute with these appellants. It only says that he must arbitrate a dispute arising between him and a member firm of the Exchange, which is what Kidder Peabody is.
Is your point that the Exchange Act rules, their scope is a question of federal law rather than California law?
I'd have to defer on it. I do not have the answer for you as to what rule of construction would apply. I am simply saying under any rule of construction, if the agreement in black and white says that Mr. Thomas will arbitrate any disputes as required by the Exchange, and the Exchange does not require him to arbitrate disputes with co-employees but only with a member firm, then there is no language there requiring him to arbitrate a dispute.
What about the cases that Mr. Dolan referred us to, Becker and another
And Berman. Let's talk about Berman, because Berman was a case in 1975 where the stock exchange company moved to compel arbitration in the same proceeding as the co-employees. But we don't have that here, because Kidder Peabody is not before this court. They brought a separate action in the federal district court, which these co-employees did not join.
What difference would that make?
Well, because they're an indispensable party to the agreement. They are the contracting party. It is through the contracting party that these beneficiaries are seeking as appendages of the corporation to get the benefit of arbitration.
Well, what about Becker?
I am not familiar with that enough to respond, Your Honor. But I was certainly on the case of Berman and the other cases that they had relied in the court below, that is Ross versus Mathis, there was no such situation where the corporation goes off to the federal court and runs the motion up the federal flagpole, and the co-employees bring the same motion in the state court and runs it up the state flagpole. So here we're over in the federal court with Kidder Peabody. We're in the state court with the co-employees. I think they lack standing.
Yeah, but this promise to arbitrate that's written in the contract does, on its face and under California law, refer to disputes with co-employees.
That's right, but it incorporates by reference.
I know, but it incorporates by reference just the kind of disputes.
It actually mandates the arbitration.
The description of the arbitrable disputes in the rules, the stock exchange rules.
What it says is that the Mr. Thomas, need only arbitrate those disputes which are required by the exchange.
Your position renders without any other person in the contract, it makes it surplusage.
Well, that is the they are the drafters of that agreement.
Well, I know, but I think the reference to the New York Stock Exchange rules could certainly mean that referring to the types of disputes that would be arbitrable.
Well, I believe the exchange rules specifically say that you need only arbitrate those disputes with a member corporation. And let me
show
you how.
That's a different point. That's a different point.
Okay. But let me tell you how I think it would apply here, Justice White. We have a situation where Mr. Thomas feels sorely aggrieved by not having received his wages.
Mm-hmm.
As a side note, you need not plead a violation of labor code in bringing such an action. You bring an action for denial of your wages, and so I think that counsel has raised a red herring in that regard. Now, if these appellants, these co-employees, are acting in the course and scope of their employment in the course of denying my client his wages, then the only liability is on the member corporation, and quite obviously under the rules of the New York Stock Exchange, then there would be some application there. But these are co-employees who have taken from him his money. They have allegedly taken his wages, and for them to claim that they're entitled to the benefit of the agreement doesn't follow. Now, I have one more important issue that I wish to address, and I believe that this is perhaps the most important issue we have. And that is that the rules of the New York Stock Exchange, which appellants are proffering here, are simply unfair. Now, in Justice Marshall's decision for the court in Byrd, noted in footnote 2, the court did not address that issue. It said that Byrd had not raised the adhesive nature of the contract in the court below, and that this court would not address it. We feel that the rules of the New York Stock Exchange are unfair in two regards. First, the arbitrator who is going to sit in judgment of this case and to make a binding decision is appointed by the New York Stock Exchange, of which Appellant's Corporation is a member firm. We feel that there is an institutional bias, and it's not simply that the arbitrator would be unfair. We're not saying that the arbitrator would be unfair, but as this court has noted in many other contexts, it's simply the appearance of unfairness that so offends constitutional notions. If the rules of the New York Stock Exchange was to use what we use in California, such as retired judges or the auspices of the American Arbitration Association, it would not be so offensive as the present rules. Secondly, the rules of the New York Stock Exchange do not allow a meaningful opportunity for discovery. There is only one provision in there regarding discovery, and that says is that the parties will exchange such documents as will expedite the proceeding. There is no judicial review. Each side would have unfettered control over which documents would be divulged and which ones would be not. And this simply turns hundreds of years of judicial...
I don't understand what you're saying. This is unconstitutional. This isn't government action. This is private action. I assume two parties agree by contract that if there's any dispute between them, it shall be resolved by a flip of the coin. Is that unconstitutional?
Yes, Your Honor. That
it is.
That would simply, to my thinking, that would simply the judicial system on its head.
This is a private contract. It's not a judicial system. You and I enter a contract, and we decide, look, lawyers are too expensive. If we have a dispute, we'll resolve it by a flip of the coin. It's one of the things we agreed to. It's part of the deal.
Well, you know, I could only draw an analogy perhaps to a different area that may raise the court's suspicion. That would be if an individual was to move into a say, a condominium, and Shuri signs an agreement to arbitrate any dispute, I could not believe that this court would say that if there was a restrictive covenant in that condominium agreement, that the court would not look with suspicion at the agreement and say, we don't care the fact that these people agree to the things. There are certain things that so offend our sense of justice that we wouldn't tolerate it. And I think the same applies here, that to say that a wage earner must abide by some agreement that even you had difficulty reading, and it's not much larger than the original, and that by doing so, he waives not just important constitutional rights to jury trial and discovery and the like, but perhaps the recovery itself. I don't think it would be tolerated, and I don't think it should be tolerated. And if the court has nothing further...
Federal constitutional law of void contracts void because of undue influence or... you know, there are a lot of state laws that make certain contracts unenforceable because they're oppressive or one-sided or something, but I've never heard of a theory that as a matter of constitutional law, we're going to go around picking out those contracts that are just so egregious that they can't be enforced. Do you have any case that says anything anywhere near that? I mean, California can do that if it wants. It can say you can't enter into a contract like this. You can't provide to resolve a contractual dispute by flip of the coin. They may well say that, but I never heard of federal constitutional policing of private contracts.
Well, I believe it falls upon the judiciary to fashion the limitations on the Federal Arbitration Act as a matter of federal common law. And I believe in so fashioning such a remedy that the court would draw upon basic senses of fairness and fair play. And if the court has nothing further, I...
Thank you, Mr. Galber. Mr. Dolan, you have 6 minutes remaining.
Very briefly, I'd like to respond to the points raised by Mr. Galber. I'm pleased that his reliance on Ware has shrunk from 100%, where it was 2 years ago, now down to 80%. But I still don't think that it's the appropriate controlling authority. Southland clearly is, and it falls, unfortunately, to this court to tell the California Court of Appeal that it is. And it made no attempt to deal with it itself, and regrettably, that's what brings us here. I would like to turn to the last wage claim question as to whether or not it's egregious to contemplate that a wage claim would be resolved by arbitration or by any other mechanism other than a judicial proceeding. The very Article 1 that 229 refers to includes Section 206, which specifically talks about a labor commissioner mechanism for the recovery of wage claims, which is indeed the most common way that wage claims are asserted in California. The method is that the employee goes down to the labor commissioner, makes an assignment of the wage claim, fills out a form, the labor commissioner conducts a hearing within 10 days, according to the statute, issues a ruling. The employer either pays the wage claim at that point in time or can seek judicial review. So the state of California itself has provided an alternative mechanism for Mr. Thomas to recover the contended wages without resorting to the courts and without regard to an arbitration agreement. Now, our position, as I indicated earlier, is not that.
You said without regard to the arbitration agreement. Why wouldn't that procedure be preempted, too?
Because that is the authority of the state.
No, but under the federal Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act, it seemed to me it would preempt that procedure if the wage earner had signed an agreement to arbitrate.
The question is whether or not the Federal Arbitration Act would
preempt the California procedure you just described. He couldn't use that procedure, could he, under your view of the case?
Well, our view of the case is that this is not essentially a wage claim, and the claims that are covered in the case are not.
If it is a wage claim.
If it is a wage claim.
In your view, could your opponent use the California procedure you've just described?
Well, or we could raise perhaps the arbitration agreement as a defense. Well,
I'm asking you whether that would be a good defense in such a proceeding. What is your view?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, I haven't focused on it. We never have. It doesn't make the whole purpose of
the
arbitration.
Answer is you don't know. Is that what it is?
No. Why do we want arbitration in the first place? We want arbitration in the first place to get a quick, expeditious resolution of the claim.
I don't know why you want it. I'm asking you whether, in your view of the case, if you objected to using the statutory procedure that you've just described, do you think you should prevail or not? think there are only four answers, yes, no, I don't know, or I won't say.
I appreciate those, Justice Scalia. The problem is that I'm now being put in a position of serving as the Attorney General of California and arguing.
You're telling me what your view of the issue you've asked us to decide is. What is the extent of the preemption that flows from Section 2 of the Federal Arbitration Act?
My position is that it would not prevent the Labor Commissioner from making the inquiry.
I don't think that's an answer to my question.
Well, I'm trying to parse out the role of the state agency under the legislation.
Does it have the power to decide the issue? In the face of an objection that the federal statute has preempted this particular procedure.
Because of the arbitration agreement.
Yes, and that's what you're arguing. You've preempted the procedure in state court, and now you just said, well, there's another state procedure they could have taken. Well, I don't see how they could have taken that if you're right on your principal submission.
The private litigant, Mr. Thomas, would be bound by the arbitration agreement, and we could contend that his claim presented to the to the Labor Commissioner was barred by the arbitration agreement and the Federal Arbitration Act.
I know you could contend that. I keep asking you, should you, in your view of the case, prevail when you make that contention?
I think you're saying
I don't know.
Yes.
All right.
But,
so that it is available to him.
Having said that, I am not saying that the Labor Commissioner is precluded from undertaking his statutory investigation with respect to all of the things covered in Article 1. And therein lies the difference in applying 229. 229 talks about the powers to enforce the provisions. 217 gives enforcement powers to a state agency.
In other words, you say he could conduct an investigation, but he couldn't make a decision. Well, why can't the trial judge here conduct a lot of discovery and say, I think this is the way it looks, but I can't decide it?
No. Among other things the Labor Commission can do is bring an action in the name of the state of California for a penalty. Let's assume under your scenario that the wages were owed to Mr. Thomas, and we resisted Mr. Thomas's assignment to the Labor Commissioner under the arbitration agreement. And we said, I'm sorry, but the Federal Arbitration Act governs, and to the extent that 206 is inconsistent, you, Mr. Thomas, may not proceed. Fine. Now the Labor Commissioner says, that's fine with Mr. Thomas. He doesn't have a civil remedy, if you will. But I, as the Labor Commissioner of California, I'm not precluded from carrying out, because of his arbitration agreement, my statutory mandate, which include, among other things, suing for a civil penalty payable only to the state of California. My position is that that's what 229 is talking about, that the state agencies are not inhibited by a private arbitration agreement between Thomas and Kidder Peabody or Thomas and Perry or anybody else. And we don't contend they were. And no one ever has said that.
But it'd be okay for him to collect a penalty. So is his punitive damage claim?
No, the penalty is payable to the state of California, expressly provided in the statute that the action is brought in the name of the Labor Commissioner and payable to the state of California.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan. The case is submitted. We'll hear argument next.